Hi, I'm Eric Kaplan. I'm a philosopher and a writer in Southern California.
And
Tao, why don't you say who you are?
I'm Tao Ruspoli, and I'm also an aspiring philosopher, and I'm coming to you from Bombay Beach, California.
And you are listening to Terrifying Questions, or How Not, and Terrifying Questions and How Not to Be Terrified by Them, a philosophy and comedy podcast where we look at frightening questions and deep questions, unsettling questions, and we try to get through to a place of greater courage and joy. So welcome.
Thank you, and welcome to all of our listeners. I'm the temporary co-host with great honor, and we keep doing unusual settings of our podcast. We did one from a meeting of the American Society of Existential Phenomenologists. We did a kind of documentary style one last week with my friend Jeff Dyer and your new friend. And now we're coming to you live from the Windmill House in Bombay Beach, California, where we're preparing the next Bombay Beach Biennale, which is in its eighth iteration. And I'm excited to have you come back for the second time to the Biennale.
Me too.
And so why don't you tell us our terrifying question for today?
Okay, our terrifying question is, can you learn anything important from another person?
Now, when you proposed this, it seemed such an obvious yes. I said yes just primarily because I wanted to hear the counter arguments, because I have trouble understanding even what it would mean to live in a world where we can't understand, where we can't learn from other people. I'm not sure how else we learn things. I suppose there's like direct experiences, but even those often involve other people. So could you make the case for why it might not be the case?
I guess I'm sort of thinking at it from the point of view of, like, if somebody came to me and said, should I live a life of love and risk, or should I live a life of playing it safe? I would think the answer would have to be, don't ask me, figure it out for yourself. So maybe I'm high, I will confess, I'm making a high standard of what counts as important, because obviously if somebody wants to ask me, I don't know, do I think it's a good idea to live in Brooklyn, I can say, well, here's the plus and minuses of living in Brooklyn. And that could easily be helpful. And, you know, they wouldn't even need me. They could just Google it, right? Or ask ChatGPT or something. But when it comes to actual questions about how to live your life, I'm at least skeptical about the idea that anybody can teach anybody about these things. And I sort of feel like really tempted by the answer, figure it out yourself. Don't ask somebody else.
Well, I mean, first of all, we're all living lives that would be impossible if we hadn't learned as a culture and as a civilization from each other, right? I mean, we're all, everything that I can see in this moment comes from things that not only I've learned from other people, but each generation and each person has depended on knowledge based on generations before in order to develop all the technology.
Right. That's not what I'm interested in. I'm not interested in how do you make a crystal radio. Obviously, we can learn that and we should. Although, interestingly, we don't need to learn that from a person. We could learn that from a database. What I'm worried about or proposing that we talk about is, can you learn anything in the, like, how to live your life department from another person?
Right.
Or do you need to enroll and get a diploma from the School of Hard Knocks instead?
I mean, I guess we have to also make some distinctions, as it always
sure.
podcast, sure. between, like, explicit knowledge and embodied knowledge, I would, for lack of a better word, because obviously we learn, and now I'm thinking of like the way I learn from my partner a different way to live that I would not imagine knowing about if it weren't for this existence that we share together, for example. So
what'd you learn?
I mean, it's again, it's hard to make explicit because I think there's like there's deep knowledge that we don't, that is hard to put into words, or you put into words, you're already losing something about it. But we can try. I mean,
yeah, give it a shot.
I think it would be like learning ways to arrange the day and approach the combination of work and creativity and intimacy and you know, the way you arrange your life with another person. You don't arrange your life, you've been married many years, you have children. I don't think your life is arranged in a very substantive ways according to this relationship that you share with somebody. Would you not say?
Right. I guess
does that count as learning?
Well, that's the question, right? Because let's say we're doing something together, right? We're carrying, like that story in Aesop of the father and the son who are carrying a donkey. Then the partnership has to, in a sense, learn through experience how to carry that donkey. And I'm using the donkey as a metaphor for the burdens of life. Like you need to, as a partnership, figure some stuff out. But then I would sort of revert to my idea that the partnership of Tao and Dulcinea has to learn on its own and cannot learn from some other partnership. Like you cannot go to like Eric and Raduca and say, how do we do it? And we'll say, you got to do this. Like, I don't think that works. So I'm digging in. I'm protecting my position, but I'm digging in. But now saying that amongst the things that can learn things are collectives, not just people.
Good. I like that. So then I thought that.
But I'm glad you're pushing me because I think this is interesting.
I do too. So I thought, I was thinking before the podcast that there would be three examples of how we learn from each other. That one would be from our parents as we're growing up.
That's interesting.
That also includes learning how not to do things probably often. And then there's, but we look to these people who are, you know, probably we look up to them hopefully for many years. And then we have teachers, which even it's in the name, teaching, right? And I've had great relationships that have shaped me. And I want to go deeper into that because we shared the same teacher. It's a big influence on both of our lives. So I think you have teachers and professors, and then we have partners. So I thought, and then I'm sure you learn from your children too, but I don't have children yet, so I can't speak to that, but I can imagine that would be the fourth big important type.
Are you thinking you might? Is it something you'd like to do?
I think I'm not closed to the idea, nor am I seeking it in the immediate future. So
right.
It's I'm agnostic, but that's a whole other episode.
Oh, but so, terrifying question. Should Tao have children?
It is terrifying for other people, for the children, probably the most. So let's start at the beginning. We're small children and we need to make our way in the world. Obviously, we learn some things, as you say, by figuring it out, but it's a very inefficient way to learn things, or at least if it was by itself. If you had kids like just alone in the world trying to figure things out, I imagine humanity, not only the child's life, but humanity as a whole would not move forward very well if we weren't learning from our peers.
Let's take the example of language learning.
Yeah.
Now that's interesting because obviously we need other people around to learn a language, and we need to learn a language, but they're not teaching it to us. They're just letting us soak it up. So I'm wondering maybe my question should be sharpened up a little bit, because that's obviously true. Obviously we learn a language and that's important, and no one could learn it on their own, so sure. But I wonder whether
the language alone, according to Right. There couldn't even be a private language.
No, there couldn't be language if people did not share it. But I wonder whether what I'm trying to say should be, here's a weak claim, and I feel like I might be able to advance something stronger than this weak claim, but I'll advance this, which is that nothing very important is ever learned by someone teaching it to somebody else. Because I don't think language, we teach it to somebody else. I think we just sort of put the person in a situation where they can absorb it. But maybe that's fine.
Can you clarify that distinction? Can you go deeper into what the difference is between teaching something and absorbing it when someone else does it?
Okay, let's think of a couple differences. One is, you need not know anything about English or the rules of English or how English differs from any other language. And you need not wish to teach English. And if you speak English around a child of the right age, they'll learn it. And maybe you want to say that, you know, we're talking about, you know, gurus, and, you know, the way in which a parent might teach you how to be a man or how to be a husband or, you know, how to get dressed. And maybe there's all that stuff that happens based upon our primary role models. And then if we run into other people in this world who we admire, we can model our behavior on them too. And I do think that happens. But I guess I'm sympathetic to the idea that the real name of the game is your decision to pick these people rather than their decision to show anything to you. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I should just abandon this whole idea. But you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, I like the idea of winning the terrifying questions debate.
Yeah, yeah, and then you could advance to the round, and then
I don't think you should give up so easily.
I shouldn't, because I was thinking you could then go on, like I could leave, and then you could fight someone else next week, possibly Robert Pippin,
who was here at the Bombay Beach.
I know. Zero. I'm sorry I missed him, but that year I needed to put in the begonias.
But so I want to get into specifics because I have a great gratitude for a specific teacher mm-hmm. who I think taught me not only philosophy and made me decide to study philosophy. I was going to be an architect. Mm-hmm. And at Berkeley, it was so fun that you got to choose.
Yeah.
Unlike high school, you get to choose the courses you take. And mm-hmm. I always loved philosophy, so I read philosophy books on my own time. But I didn't think you could actually be a philosopher unless you're going to be a professor. So, and I know I didn't want to be a professor. Mm-hmm. So I didn't even consider philosophy as a pursuit. And then, but I realized you could take a class just for fun. Mm-hmm. And I see in the course book, I'm a freshman at UC Berkeley, and there's a class called Existentialism in Literature and Film. And I was like, ooh, that looks great. So I signed up for it, and I show up in this room, and it's one of the most popular courses at Berkeley worldwide, because it was one of the first courses that was podcast out in the 90s already. Bert Dreyfuss, the professor, was profiled on the news because truck drivers were listening to his lectures from Berkeley, and this was very new at the time. And he was, by all accounts, a great teacher. Mm-hmm. And saw his art form and his craft as more teaching than it was philosophy, even. And his favorite philosopher that he thought most about was Heidegger. And Heidegger said that if you want to teach, you have to teach by example. And the example the teacher has to give is one who learns.
Uh-huh. I remember that because the first paper in grad school I wrote for Bert was about philosophy of education. That's what I thought my field was going to be. And we found this thing where he says a teacher is, because Heidegger always likes to switch around the concept of activity, is that a teacher is someone who lets learn.
Exactly. Because I want to get into that, into the idea, because maybe we can find a bridge between my position and yours and the idea of like learning being like opening yourself to the world and being receptive to it in some way. And then the teacher is someone who helps open you up to learn.
By being open himself, by modeling being open.
Exactly. Spoiler alert. So I witnessed this great teacher doing his thing, which was one of the most surprising aspects of his teaching was that, and I then found this across the board in masters of different fields, not only teaching, but also whether it's filmmaking or carpentry or music, there's a constant recognition that there's more to be learned. I thought when I saw people who hit a ceiling before hitting the ultimate mastery, and so far as that might even exist, I saw people who did very well in their careers but didn't go all the way, I noticed they always were the ones who thought they knew everything. And the people who I most admired, who had, you know, who seemed to be great learners and therefore great teachers also, and this is also when I like had apprenticeships with filmmakers later on, there was this constant willingness to admit that you could still had a lot to learn and you were going to stop learning. So Bert Dreyfuss would do this in front of the class. Every time someone asked a question, you would think after 25 years of teaching the same course, you would easily say, of course, I know the answer to that. You're just a little lowly freshman kid. I don't learn, I teach you. And so, but there was never that attitude. There was always this sense like, oh my God, that's a really interesting question. Let me think about it. And that was so inspiring to watch. And it was like philosophy happening before your eyes. You're watching this great philosopher learn in front of you. And then it put you in this disposition, disposedness towards learning and this kind of openness. And I think that in addition to all the content of what I might have learned in philosophy from this great teacher, it was this kind of openness to learning constantly that I think counts as one of your something important to learn from someone.
Sure. So now I'm curious about something, which is there's two different kinds of people who don't know anything. There's the kind of person like Bert who didn't know anything, but he also kind of did know a lot. And then there's a kind of person who literally doesn't know anything. And like, let's say like there's somebody, I mean, this actually exists. There's somebody who's actually a professor in the music department. And now they've been forced to teach an intro to philosophy. And you come in and you say, why are we studying philosophy? And they say, I don't know. And then they say, you say, well, who are the great philosophers? And they say, I don't know. Like that's a bad kind of not knowing, but then Bert had a good kind of not knowing. What's the difference?
Yeah, I think obviously there is a huge chasm of difference there.
Sure, and, one would hope.
So I think so someone who's been learning and been open to the world for decades, and he had a whole skill model. So it's a really we're operating on many levels here.
Because, yeah, we are at least
there's. So he was very interested in how we learn and master skills. And then I picked up this interest and made a film about it, which was exploring how skillful mastery leads to also a more meaningful existence. So the stakes are high too.
Yeah, they are.
The idea is that if we don't know anything and we don't master skills, life could be much emptier than it is. Develop deep skills, right? So then the question is, how do we learn these skills?
And we could even bring in the same question, because there's a sense in which the master does not know any rules. And there's a sense in which the Zen mind is the beginner's mind. But then I'll just pose the same question, which is, what's the difference between how the master doesn't know any rules and how the ignoramus doesn't know any rules? Why isn't every beginner's mind a Zen mind?
Yeah,
if every Zen mind is a beginner's mind.
If Bert was right, the skill model was, and this also had huge implications in the field of artificial intelligence, which is very on everyone's mind. So the question was, used to maybe the traditional philosophical thought around this would be that we have to think about rules, and you have to impart rules, and then the master is the person who knows the rules the best.
Yes.
Instead, Bert didn't say that that wasn't necessary. He just said that you're missing some steps after that. And I think that's the big difference, right? Like, yes, at the beginning, if you're learning to, let's say his favorite example was driving a stick shift. When you first get in the car, if you're going to make the car go, you're going to need to follow certain rules. You're going to like know that the first gear is in the top left. And then you're going to know that after maybe it reaches certain RPMs, you're going to want to shift gears. And the problem with the rules is that they're based on generalities, and generalities only go so far because the specific situation often varies from those generalities. And so the master starts to become tuned in to the particularities of the unique situation, and then the rules have to give way. And then the tradition might say that that's the rules have just become unconscious. But then Bert said, well, that's like saying I learned to ride a bicycle how do you call them, the training wheels, but now I don't need the training wheels anymore, so therefore the training wheels must have become invisible.
Right. Yes. So here's the thing, or here's a thing, which is the master of driving the car. We all kind of know what that looks like, even if we are not good at driving the car, because you get there without crashing it. If in terms of the stick, you know, it's smooth rather than jerky, stuff like that, is like the clutch doesn't give out, what have you. But when it comes to how to live your life, and this is a Bert example, like you could have people leading radically different lives. You could have someone who is devoting himself to outrageous works of art, and someone else who is disappearing into every social situation in order to help people and make it easier for them, like, you know, the artist and the saint. And they're both, on Bert's model, masters of being human, but it strikes me as weird that I don't know why it strikes me as weird. I guess it strikes me as weird, like one thing I want to say is, which one you choose to follow is not something you can learn from either of them. So that makes me wonder who you could learn it from and how you could learn it. So I sort of feel like you have to either learn it from yourself or from the mysterious universe itself. I don't know. But I don't feel like another human could teach you that. But what, or could another human teach you that?
One of the prerequisites of becoming a master is a commitment to that thing that you're trying to master, right? Because if you are constantly improvising, and today I want to be a carpenter, and tomorrow I want to be a philosopher, and the next day I want to be a musician, you might never reach that mastery.
Could you become a master dilettante? Can you be a master at being a jack of all trades, do you think?
Maybe. I don't, yeah, maybe. But I think where I was going with this is that I think that you can learn by example, by seeing what it's taken other masters to get to where they are. So if you want to be a great philosopher, you might look at the trajectory of Bert's career. If you want to be a great, you know, jazz pianist, you might look at the great jazz pianists who have come before you, and you'll learn from them that, you know, being great isn't just going on stage and being great, but it involves all sorts of steps along the way, which involve commitment, involve risk, involve practice, involve all of the things that are on this skill model. But I think neat examples that we look up to, and this is, we go back to the kind of embodied knowledge that isn't necessarily explicit, because you might just see somebody who you aspire to be like, and it's not in what they say, but it's in what they are and how they embody their mastery. And then
But what is it that allows the ignoramus or the adolescent to pick a master? Is it just superficial glitter and social prestige that you're just like, I'm seeing that guy stepping up on a stage playing a guitar and everybody's looking at him. I want everybody to look at me. Like, that's not a good model, right?
No, and then I don't know how much agency you want to ascribe to it too, because a lot of people who are really great at things, they say that it picked them as much.
Interesting.
It, right? So that, I think that you come back.
So maybe the person is not the teacher. Maybe the skill is the teacher.
Yeah, the world. In Heidegger's language, you have domains or you have worlds, not as in the earth, but you have the world of jazz. You have the world of philosophy.
So the world of philosophy just picked you and used Bert as like a tool for shaping you. Is that the picture?
I think it's probably a bit of both, and we probably the distinction between the world and the people in it is not as clear cut as we'd like, as we might make it. I think the world is made of the people in it, and the traditions and the skills that have developed in that time. So like our friend Mark Rathel says in Being in the World, he says, it's not like the world of jazz was somewhere in the Middle Ages, like waiting for someone to discover it.
No, I don't think so.
Or was it invented from scratch, but somehow it emerged out of a rich tradition and a specificity of a place and time where those traditions came in. And then what you couldn't have predicted, you know, and in thinking about it in today's terms, like if you fed, someone did a thought experiment saying, if you fed all of music up until the year 1900 into a large language model, you might be able to say, okay, let's blend, you know, Mozart and African, you know, tribal music, and it might be able to do some sort of Frankenstein thing like that. But the jazz would never emerge from that. It's not like in there. It's like it emerges from it. There's like a kind of clearing in this language again, like that a world can kind of whoosh up. And it's made up of the people in it, and it's made up of the tradition, and of this kind of practices of a
right.
culture.
Right. So on this picture, I think we may have wandered away from at least my question, which is whether we need to learn from other people. Because it sounds on this tradition, on this view, that the world is whooshing into existence. And if you're lucky enough to be sucked up into that, you'll do something interesting with your life, and if you're not, you won't.
So, but I want to say like, the people in it are really important. So I don't think the world of the blues is more than just the individuals who played, but each of those great blues players contributed in really meaningful ways. And I think that if you were lucky enough to be around one of these greats, you would learn something important from these people, that, and your life would be markedly different than it would be if you hadn't met these
people. Sure. So I guess maybe here's a way of asking this question, which is, I'm not going to ask this yet. I'm going to ask something else. What I'm going to ask is, does the following model seem right? That Bert Dreyfus has been kicked around by philosophy, and he's gotten in his bones what seems like an interesting question that's going to give him some juice and it's going to help him, and also what seems like a boring question and what seems like a worthwhile problem that's worth putting time into, and what kind of problem seems like a waste of time. And he's got the kind of virtue, courage to deal with that, and that's so cool that you just want to be around it. And then when you're around these kind of courageous people who have been kicked around by the quest, then you can kind of get some courage and some skill for your own quest. How does that strike you?
I mean, that seems like a way to tell the story that works. I think it might be useful to also give a little kind of historical context on why, because obviously there's the side of the story, which is that he had an influence on us as a teacher.
Yeah, but he did.
Then there's the historical context that he was interested in, and which is very relevant today, which is not only how people learn things, but is it possible for a computer to learn something? And where is our human being different from the way that a computer is, right?
Well, I'll say one thing about your example about putting all of music at the year 1900 into a computer is I don't even know what that means. What would it like the, because music includes how people move their bodies all over the world. How would you precisely put the way people move their bodies all over the world into a computer? What does it even mean? It seems like a poorly, like a kind of a poorly imagined example. And I'm not blaming you for it. I think the people who are pushing this model are a little naive about what it would mean to put something into a computer.
You're predicting where I was going to go with this. I wanted to make a couple extra steps. So because the traditional philosophical story about what makes human beings special and different from animals and objects in the world, for thousands of years people thought, or philosophers thought, that what made us special is that we were thinking things, right? That mm-hmm. we had reason, and we could we would learn things by having rules that could be made explicit, and that the thing that was most special about being human was that we could think rationally about the world, right? Mm-hmm. And in this model, a body is not so important, right? It's just like the body is kind of actually the opposite of important. It gets in the way. We're actually just thinking things that happen to have to lug around these imperfect things. But in the world of thought, everything's much more beautiful and perfect and ideal. And, you know, Plato was the big proponent of this, but his influence lasted for thousands of years after his death, right? Mm-hmm. And so what Burt's genius was in the 1950s, he was at MIT, which is, very technologically inclined school. The philosophy department probably was not so important, but he was there teaching philosophy at a school that was more famous for math and engineering. And a lot of this kind of emphasis on rationality and on disembodied thought was where it was at. And mm-hmm. and at the time, the computer was a new invention. This is the 1950s. And of course, human beings tend to always think that they are essentially whatever the latest clever invention that they've come up with is. So as soon as they came up with the computer, they thought, oh, well, human beings must be computers too.
Yes.
So not only have we figured out what you philosophers have not been able to figure out for thousands of years, what makes human beings special, but we've now reduced it to a machine, and we're going to be able to create an artificial human within a few years. This was like the claim that a lot of people were making in the AI world in the 1950s. And Burt, being an unassuming, you know, kind of adorable little man, without being belittling, I obviously looked up to him very much, but his whole demeanor was very kind of, he was like a, I think John Hoagland said, like a little insect almost. Yeah.
I would like people to think of him as a beautiful butterfly rather than a cockroach, if we're talking about insects.
But he had this like, you know, wild red hair, and he was kind of just rebellious and
a scary. Shrimpy redheaded guy is how my dad described him.
And so here he was in the philosophy department at MIT, which, you know, was not the most respected department, probably. They didn't think the philosophers had anything important to say about the world. And he was saying, you know, guys, you're basing your whole research program of artificial intelligence on an outdated view of what it is to be human. If you read these new philosophers coming out of Europe, which was the existential phenomenologists like Heidegger
and Merleau-Ponty, most specifically, yeah.
Also Foucault and... Mm-hmm. You would realize that to be human is not to just have abstract rational thoughts, but it is to be always already in the world with a body, right? And that a lot of these, and this is why I asked you earlier, like, are there things that we learn that aren't necessarily able to be made explicit? Because we learn things by being with each other and mm-hmm. by move with each other. And Dreyfus talked a lot about, for example, we have skills that we don't even realize are skills, like distance standing practices. You might have gone your whole life without thinking about how far you should stand from someone
right.
to talk to them. Right. And you might not remember who taught you that because you never thought about it at all. But the moment you go to another culture where people stand closer to each other, suddenly it might become very apparent that you do have a skill and you're uncomfortable with the fact that other people have a skill that looks different in this very same domain, right?
Right.
So that's like an example of something that you might learn. And Bert would talk about, how you would teach these embodied practices even from the moment of infancy, like the way that Japanese mothers might put a baby on its back more often and it therefore like inculcate a certain receptivity to the world, and Western mothers were more apt to put their baby's stomach down because they would want the baby to crawl around and be more active. Mm-hmm. So there's a type of learning from someone that just you might never think about.
Right. I wonder whether maybe conflict amongst teachers is good, because when we see our teachers in conflict, it sort of broadens the conceptual space of what it could be to be a human. Like, I think it's interesting that the Talmud says an interesting thing that one of the signs of a good teacher is that they're like a poisonous snake, like they're vengeful and hostile to other teachers. And it's always like kind of struck with me because I'm like, no, wouldn't the best teacher be like kind and gentle? But it's almost like you're learning this ability in the individual teacher to fight for a position. And that teaches you that the positions are important, even if you yourself don't end up agreeing with them. I just think about how in the history of philosophy, like there are these sort of, it often comes down to us in these sort of dueling pairs, you know, that we have Kierkegaard fighting with Hegel. We have Plato fighting with Aristotle. In the Middle Ages, we have the Scotus fighting with Aquinas. There's the nominalists versus the realists. And maybe that's good, or maybe that's a profound thing about how to receive, how to learn, is to realize that there are these warring positions, and there are even these warring positions within us. I don't know. Just because I guess one of the things I'm sort of trying to like hash out in my own mind is like, how can we both accept that learning is, you know, very important, and there are these heroic figures that we like, but also that to simply find the heroic figure and turn into a copy of that heroic figure is a betrayal. It's not actually learning what one should learn. I don't know what I'm saying. Tao, tell me what I'm saying.
Well, I think this idea of conflict is good because it also harkens back to the idea of never resting on your laurels, like the mm-hmm. idea that there's always something you're pushing up against. Mm-hmm. So that was another thing that in this philosophy is that the world is something that pushes back in a way that forces you to be receptive to it.
Right.
Oh, so for right. example, if you had a material that was malleable in any infinite number of ways, mm-hmm. and it was just your will exerted on that material, what would emerge would be less interesting than if you were working with like wood or marble that had its own kind of, I don't want to ascribe too much agency to the material, but there's like a kind of power to the material.
So were we Bert's material, do you think? Are the students his material as a teacher?
Yeah, because we are the ones that would force him to respond to the unique situation.
Right.
So the way that you learn most effectively is response to not to the generality, which is where the rules live, but to the unique situation. So when you ask the question to Bert, rather than like file it into the category of like dumb student questions that all would have the same answer. He would be responding to the unique question that was brought about in that unique moment. And there was this kind of receptivity to the specificity of the situation. And
so
I think
I was gonna ask
the marker
you,
of a great master.
I was gonna ask you how you think people can be better teachers, but what you just said made me think of a better and more interesting question. So sometimes people say that people end up getting the bad government that they deserve. You know, in other words, they haven't taken responsibility over their society enough to demand a better government. So they're lied to by various hucksters, as we see happening in our country today. I'm wondering whether if we complain about pompous or shallow teachers, that's on us, and whether we are getting the teachers we deserve. And that makes me want to ask the question, if you meet someone, what kind of attitude will turn them into the best teacher? Like, how do you get the most juice out of the orange that every teacher is? And it also makes me think of another, I think it was some Buddhist teacher I met. I think it was Lungpo Tian. I don't really remember his name, but he was in Thailand. And he said, the person in front of me, my teacher, the person to the right of me, my teacher, the person behind me, my teacher, that the best student is someone who's able to sort of learn from everybody. And that sounds corny if you choose to make it corny, but I think it can also be pretty deep. And I want to kind of explore that with you. Like, how do you get people to teach you?
Yeah, and you studied in the East, right? Because the whole Zen tradition has a rich practice around learning. Isn't it even like the teacher should beat the student with a stick sometimes?
The mercy stick, yeah, that's true. There was this funny thing I learned, not personally, but from a book from Lungpo Mahabua, maybe it was his teacher. His teacher was Ajahn Mun. Ajahn Mun said this to Mahabua, which is they don't want to answer stupid questions. They want to ignore questions that they think you could figure out on your own. So they're very selective about what questions to answer, which I thought was pretty cool because it was just so counterintuitive, because I would have thought you want to answer all the questions, and Bert certainly thought that way. But I think there's another question, which is, what should the student do in order to get the best teaching from each person we encounter?
This might be too neat of a knot to tie it into, but it just occurred to me, so I'm going to throw it out there. At the beginning, we posited two seemingly contrasting notions. On
yes.
one side, you have the idea that someone teaches you something, and on the other hand is you have somebody figuring stuff out on their own. And maybe the place we land is that the best teacher teaches you how to figure it out on your own.
Yeah, I think
because
that's possibly
you the
right.
Answer, giving you the answer is a superficial way to learn something. So if I say, what did Kierkegaard think about X, Y, and Z? And the professor just tells me, it's not nearly as effective as if he tells me how to go and figure and learn it from the text and how to read
right.
the text. I mean, it's a cliche almost, right?
Like, what do you think Kierkegaard thought? Well, I don't know. What do you think I think Kierkegaard thought? Well, what do you think I think you think Kierkegaard thought? And at some point you figure out what Kierkegaard thought, or you just get so tired.
Or the
you
world.
Decide you decide you don't care what Kierkegaard thought.
I know. And then there's the idea that the more you learn about something, the richer the world becomes. Our friend Ian Thompson is good talking about this, where like there's certain domains of literature, of philosophy, of music, that the deeper you go, the more you can learn from that
right.
text
right.
or the work. And the
which ends up making you feel stupider. Because the more you learn, the more you realize that there's all these deep, rich questions that you don't have a clue of how to answer. So that's why the one of the signs of the good teacher is humility, because the good teacher will think he doesn't know so many important things.
But one other thing we haven't talked about that's so important is that when you, as you learn, be it from the other humans or from the history of
the world or the tradition.
That domain becomes richer and richer, and it's not just a subjective experience. So the example I like for this is chess. I think this is one of Bert's examples too. So as you learn chess, when you first learn, you might just see a bunch of wooden pieces on some checkered squares.
Yes.
And that's all you see. You don't even know how to distinguish between the pieces, right?
No.
Then you learn that that's the pawn and that's the queen and what each of those pieces can do. And all of a sudden, a world of possibilities opens up to you, because certain possibilities are closed off and some are open. And you say, well, I have this ability to push the pawn forward and be aggressive. And
yeah,
and that's not just a subjective experience. The you really are being aggressive, or you really are making a mistake. You know, if you make your queen vulnerable or give her up by accident. So that those possibilities, and then as you get more and more skillful, the world gets even more nuanced and rich. So you, a very skillful chess player might say the queen looks impotent in that. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The rook is really powerful there. Again, not a subjective. It's partially subjective because it's specific to your position in that moment. But what's happened as you've learned is that the world has become this vast domain that has opened up from this skillful behavior.
Right. It also
show you
can sometimes become more elegant and simple and austere, right? As you learn that certain things like here's an example, to the skilled chess player, what the pieces are made out of is going to be significantly less important than it is to the child who doesn't know chess.
Yeah. And then you go into the abstract where maybe it doesn't even matter anymore, the physicality of the pieces, but
I would say it probably doesn't. Like if you're a top level player, you don't care very much. Like it could be all in your mind, right? It could all
and
be.
Maybe
on
that's
your
what makes
screen.
Chess less interesting than jazz or literature or philosophy.
I'll tell you what I think makes chess less interesting, which is the rules tell you who won.
Right.
And in jazz and literature and philosophy, the rules do not tell you who won. And you have these interesting cases where some people say, well, who won poetry in the 1920s? Well, it was clearly T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland. But nobody around then, with a few exceptions, thought he won. They thought it was garbage, you know? So that's so much more interesting than chess. There's nobody who, like, as far as I know, he lost all the chess he was playing, but we, in retrospect, think he was a great chess player. Is there? Could there be?
I was watching also an interview with Miles Davis the other day on YouTube, and they asked him, how do you pick the musicians you want to play with?
Oh, what did he say?
You know, the guitarist or something. And you assume that anyone who's going to go and audition for Miles Davis is going to be at a certain level of greatness. Mm-hmm. So it's not going to be the person who's never, you know, like you were saying earlier, who doesn't even know how to play at all.
No, but if he picks up the horn by the wrong end, he's not even getting into that room. That's true.
So based on that prerequisite, Miles Davis said, I look at the way the person walks. I look at the way he holds the instrument. I look at his demeanor and his disposition, because I can see the type of musician and what he's going to bring by these cues. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was so interesting, because it's like, we're talking about embodiment, right? The great chess player probably doesn't, it doesn't matter how he moves the pieces, right?
Like, I don't think it does.
It's not a rich enough world in these 64 squares. It's quite a rich world. It's amazing. It shows how worlds.
Although his level of exhaustion, you know, there is a physical element to high level chess, which people don't think about. But anyway,
I don't think it's not a domain that's where mastery and skillfulness and teaching and all this stuff can occur. But it's kind of a marginal world.
A low level case.
And it's right. You know, I think that on one side of that, you might have places where you can't have meaningful this world disclosing meaning, rich meaning.
Oh, have you ever been surprised by something that you thought was a low level case, but then turned out to be more world disclosing than you gave it credit?
Like what? What do you have in mind?
I feel kind of like I used to look down on hair cutting. Like I thought that the domain of hair arrangement was pretty boring stuff. But now I don't think that anymore. Now I think it could be pretty, you could disclose a world by your interaction with people's hair and how they present themselves with their hair and what kind of person they're going to be.
The world of the barbershop and how people like show up there and it focuses people's practices.
Yeah.
I have in mind more when I think of an impoverished world where nothing can happen is more like video games, simple board games like, you know, tic-tac-toe. I don't think you're going to disclose a world.
I don't think you could disclose a world through flipping coins. I think that's true because it can only come up really two ways.
Right.
Basically.
And then that's the problem with these computer worlds, right? It's like too rule defined and limited in this inexhaustibility that exists in these other worlds. So when you go into the haircutting world, it also spills out into there's probably the culture of the hair, you know, the school that they might.
Yeah, how you talk to the person when you're cutting their hair. Yeah.
Exactly. And then there's the kind of it's a rich domain that doesn't it's not easily defined, right?
It'd be pretty interesting if people started to come to me and they said, we met this really cool guy, and I'm like, what's so cool about him? He's got this new method of flipping coins, and we're just going to go off and just spend years hanging around this guy flipping coins. I think that'd be such an interesting conversation to have, because I wouldn't want to say you're wrong, but I would want to say you're wrong. But maybe I'm the one who's wrong. Maybe he is flipping coins in some way that has never occurred to me before.
And there's also this like there's domains where we just take it for granted that we're pretty good at that we're mastering, like walking.
That's true.
Right? So like why aren't we all in this amazing state of world disclosure when we're doing this thing so masterfully, which is just walking around? What is it that's so much more exhilarating about watching a great musician than a great walker? I think
maybe we should just lower our standards for what exhilarates us, and then we'll be exhilarated more.
Yeah, and then because the idea was that when you reach this high level of mastery, you get into a state of flow where the difference between you and the world kind of disappears. You get out of this being in your head,
right?
And the aim of it was that the skillful person is like in a state of flow, and we should look for that. Now, I don't know if we veered off too far into world disclosure and skillfulness instead of learning, but I think they're intricately and intimately tied together.
Well, I'm feeling kind of complete right now. Is there anything we should is there any stuff that's lying around the workshop that we should gather up and at least put in its place, or is there anything that you are interested in that you want to talk about before we sign off?
Well, since we started talking about Bert, I would just like to, I think people should look him up and take some of the courses that are still around. He died a few years ago, but if you're interested in this, like, skill model of how we learn and thinking about, you know, how it might apply to today's issues around artificial intelligence and being human versus being, you know, being in the human world versus the computer world. Look up the Bert Dreyfus's philosophy lectures. Also, I'll make a shameless plug for my film Being in the World, which like explores how skillful mastery is important to a meaningful existence and how technology threatens that. Because what we haven't gotten into at all is how technology takes away the need to learn skills. So for example, if you compare learning a musical instrument in the old days, if you wanted to hear music, you'd have to pick up an instrument and do the work to learn from the instrument, from your teacher, from yourself and your own, you know, the way you can get your personality through the instrument. And then you would meet other people who played complementary instruments. Mm-hmm. So if I play the violin and you play the cello, and we have two other friends and we could form a quartet, and then we would meet at a specific place in a specific at a particular time, and suddenly yeah. that place and that time would acquire significance because they were different from the times that we couldn't get together to play music, and
yeah,
we
true
room because it had great acoustics, and we would become
right right somebody was telling me that different kinds of heavy metal and punk developed in different parts of America differently because of the acoustics, and the way you would need to play heavy metal out in the desert where you are is different than the way you'd play it in Brooklyn where there's tall buildings everywhere.
Absolutely. And so those places and times and people would be individuated and therefore become meaningful. And if you compare that to the phone, where you can just put on, it doesn't matter who you are, it doesn't matter where you are, it doesn't matter what time it is, you can listen to anything, and you don't have to learn anything from anyone. What happens? The music becomes interchangeable. So you're yeah. like, I could listen to this, I could listen to this, and you don't know what you're looking for anymore, because it's not, the music isn't fitting the environment, also because it's going into your ears instead of into a shared space.
Right, so, right, right.
But when you take away the need for learning meaningful, skillful behavior, you end up in a world where all meaningful differences are flattened. So
right. and I do think
we learn from each other, but we need to like cultivate practices in which we learn from each other and develop these worlds. That's
and one of the things we also do, I think, is we become emotionally integrated, because if you think about it, if you know that some people are playing jazz in some club in your neighborhood, you have to deal with the fear that they won't like you, and the desire that they will like you, and the shame and the pride and the love. And I think when you feel those feelings on sort of not dampered, like fully, you learn a lot, and you become more than if you imagine you're just sort of getting some facts. And I'll put in a plug for the sort of love-hate relationship you can have with individual books, which I think you don't get from a Google search. And that includes this book, there's something wicked about this book, but I'm really attracted to it. Or this book is boring, but I really need to learn it. Or this book seems enjoyable, but the more I spend time reading it, the more I feel it's a waste of time. That I think like you can relate, or at least in the old days when people read books instead of just searching on the computer, you would have a relationship almost like to people. Like they were like, I guess they were a little bit like the fetishized skulls of the ancestors, that if you cradled them to your naked flesh, they would whisper to you. And that's what a book is. And I think a Google search is different. Now, maybe there'll be new ways to have equally insane relationships to Google searches as I had to books, but I'm looking forward to it.
One thing we keep like hinting at, but we haven't said explicitly, is community.
Community. I thought you were going to say eroticism. I thought you were going to say the way that you're sort of in love with the teacher.
No, I was thinking just in terms of how these practices gather community, and we learn mm-hmm. in community. And yeah. I think that the technological age, it's
and they become elective families.
It becomes isolating. And so,
do you think that your teachers are sort of an elective family, like your co? Like I feel like you, me, Mark, Ian, we're like brothers, mm-hmm. and Bert is like a chosen father, awesome. You know, and that makes it kind of juicy in a way that I like.
Yeah, and I think you have to be humble, and you have to like I think that the thought that keeps coming back to me is that we need to be receptive in order to be able to be taught. There's a way of closing yourself off to the world, and there's a way to open yourself up to others, and that's where the space opens up for us to learn from each other, and that's a beautiful thing. And but you can allow it to happen. It's possible to be in a world where we don't learn from each other, and that's a impoverished existence compared to one where you admit you don't know.
Yeah.
Someone might know something important, and hopefully then
and exist that you have needs. Admit that you have needs, that you come out into this world with needs that were not met by your family of origin, and in a state of sort of confusion and in a tizzy, as it were, and then you're out there trying to find someone who can resolve that tizzy.
All right. Well, thank you, Eric. I hope I learned. I learn from you every time we have these conversations.
And I learn from you. Yeah. So
I hope that our listeners.
And if the people at home are in an impoverished world, leave that impoverished world and find a better world. I mean, unless you're stuck, but you know, if you have the wherewithal to leave your impoverished world, then you should do it.
And come visit Bombay Beach.
Yeah, come visit Bombay Beach, of course. Okay. Okay. Beautiful. This was a good one. Thanks, Tao. Have a good evening.
Bye.
Bye.